Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. And I've got a treat for you today. Once again, we have Bill Andrews joining the podcast from Sierra Sciences, who just a couple of weeks ago gave us some updates on what's going on at his company, but also Liz Parrish of BioViva. She's going to give us some updates on recent gene therapy treatments and how she's doing health-wise. Yeah, it's been a few years since we talked with Liz, but both of them also have some good news about some positive things going on in the realm of advocacy for rejuvenation research. You definitely want to hear about that. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Bill Andrews, founder of Sierra Sciences, and Liz Parrish, founder of BioViva. Welcome, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Well, great. I'm glad that you're here. And podcast listeners might recall that just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking with Bill about Sierra Sciences, telomerase and lengthening telomeres and things like that. So I would like to first begin this podcast talking about BioViva and the latest ongoings there with Liz and your health. It was back in September of 2015, I think it was, when you were famous for taking first gene therapy that was supposed to lengthen telomeres. And then you also did myostatin upregulation, I believe, and in fact, Clotho, some treatments surrounding Clotho. And how have you been in the intervening 9 years?
Sure. So in 2015, I took the telomerase reverse transcriptase gene therapy and follistatin, actually a myostatin blocker. 5 years later, I took Clotho and PGC1-alpha. And I guess actually since you and I last spoke, I think I've taken 7 gene therapies. And I'm about to embark on another gene therapy after the beginning of the year. So how am I doing? Fantastic. Better than probably a lot of people thought I would be doing.
This makes me think of another question. And that is, you did have many critics and many people who were worried about, you know, this unregulated, untested gene therapy experiment that you were going on, and now multiple experiments. Have you talked to any of those people, doctors, researchers, different people who were very critical, and have they come back and said, hey, looks like things are going okay? You know, are they looking to you for answers now and things like that?
Well, one thing I'd like to say that, you know, I don't think anyone has said, Bill was right. Lengthening your telomeres is a really good idea. So let's start there. And then my critics, not only have they turned round face, some of them have congratulated me, and many of them now come to me to help them launch their drugs for patients. Many of those people who were critics of me in 2015 are now getting very, maybe more to the end of their careers. They've worked on drugs that haven't gotten to people. I have been successful getting patients access to technologies legally in various zones of the world. And now they want their drugs launched to people as well. So it's an about face, and it is a trajectory towards the future working together. So it's been beautiful.
And have you had to travel again for your additional gene therapies in just the last 5 years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when I did my second set of gene therapies, we actually tried international waters, and that was interesting. And then the next set of gene therapies, I also did offshore the United States.
And what were those, if you can describe the most recent? You said 7 additional gene therapies.
Well, some of them were redoing the original gene therapy, taking more dosage. Some of the studies were based around learning how to redose gene therapy so that we would actually have a protocol that we could reuse the vector that we most commonly use, which is called adeno-associated virus, or AAV. And we have perfected a protocol. We have 2 ways to do it. And we can get upregulation of the proteins by doing these 2 new protocols. So this is really exciting. And then I also did the addition of Clotho, alpha Clotho, which is associated with better cognitive performance, cardiovascular disease protection, and chronic kidney disease protection, and PGC1 alpha, which is a mitochondrial biogenesis gene. And then I have 4 more new gene candidates that I'll hopefully be doing later in 2026, but I've got some set up for 2025. Sorry.
And how did you decide what metrics did you use to know that you had to redo a couple of those gene therapies?
Well, we didn't have to redo them. I was still seeing the benefits from them, but I take that back. With telomerase reverse transcriptase, I feel that the best way to get it into most of the cells in the body is to use safe doses and to basically layer it into the system. We know that follistatin is a gene that you could put in your arm and probably would benefit many of the muscles in your body, most of them locally, but again, systemically, it's a shared protein. Telomerase reverse transcriptase needs to be in every cell of the body. That's why Bill has been working on, using a mechanism like a pill in which, a person could just take a pill and have an effect in the whole body. With gene therapy, we have a limit. We might hit 20 or 30% of the cells. And so if we want to hit all the cells in the body, we need to make sure that people are redoing that gene therapy every so many years and trying to layer it into that system.
You mentioned an effective safe dose of the AAV gene therapy, and I know they're caught wind of the FDA trying to regulate that a little bit more, something to the effect that really high dose AAV therapies were bad for people or something in that regard.
Yeah,
Can you?
they're hepatotoxic. And actually, the US FDA should have known that before they had some catastrophic outcomes. That literature was out for a multitude of years, what the toxic dose of the AAV is under the standards in which they use in their protocols with companies to treat patients. And they allowed toxic doses to be used. So that will probably lead us into a new regulatory pathway that will be safer and more adequate for patients.
And did you monitor your liver values after you got your first AAV therapy?
Oh, absolutely. And we work with a bunch of medical concierge companies and companies who license the technology out to use in different locations in which it is legal to use. And we always monitor liver values. You see in the doses that we use a slight increase of liver enzymes associated with the liver being annoyed. They're not in dangerous levels. And then they go down within 3 months. They're totally back to normal.
Okay, and speaking of the gene therapies and safe protocols, let's move on to BioViva here and what current research or experiments that you've been involved in.
Yeah, sure. So BioViva switched our pathway in a sense. We started with adeno-associated virus, again, AAV, because it has a safety profile. The US FDA likes it. It generally has a pretty smooth transition to patient treatment. But what's wrong with it is it's too small. The capacity of the vector is small. It also has immunogenetic issues. It causes, sorry, immune response, clearly. Even though we have successfully learned to redose it, it's more difficult and it requires more procedural matters around it. So we wanted to get something that was larger and could be redosed easily. And so we started working with cytomegalovirus to gut the virus, attenuate it so it can't get you sick, and make it deliver larger payloads of genetic material.
Okay, so CMV is the way BioViva is implementing most of the research now.
Yeah, that's our research is really streamlined for CMV.
Any results that you've had recently? The last time we talked, you were working on brain diseases, I believe, with a gene therapy. Any other
Yeah.
results recently?
So we did publish on the neurodegenerative disease with suspected Alzheimer's, and that was the last time we published. But what is happening in medical tourism, as far as these concierge companies where we get to look at the data, is going really well. So what we're seeing in subjects that are healthier who want to take the technology preemptively for cognitive support, we're seeing almost a standard deviation in IQ score increase. So anywhere from 9 to 14 points. And I think that that is a really important factor that's showing that it's helping people function better. We have a new licensing licensing agreement with a company called RegenCell, and hopefully we'll be working with Dr. Shelley Jordan. And he does basically the central aging clock reset, and he's going to show whether or not we can get the gene therapy to the hippocampus of the brain, because the hippocampus of the brain has Clotho that it uses there specifically right in the organ. And so this is really exciting. So you may see us publishing in the next year, year and a half again.
Great. Yeah. In the last podcast, when I talked with Bill, we talked about aging clocks, which you just mentioned briefly. And do you do any type of measurements, aging measurements? You got the aging clocks, you got the phenotypic clocks, you got different things, phenotypic age, I should say. Do you do any of those biomarker tests?
We do. We don't particularly like them. They're all over the place. They don't seem to be validated. We're not sure exactly what they mean. We know that epigenetic associated telomere length is not correct. That's not your telomere length, especially after you've taken a regenerative therapy. That's not going to meet the marks for actually measuring telomeres. We do still collect the data. We believe that the best data is visual data such as MRIs and clinically proven data such as inflammation markers and telomere lengths, actual telomere lengths, if we're doing a telomere gene therapy. But we do look at those other aging clocks, and we.
And what about functional aging tests? Would you say those are
Oh,
superior
absolutely.
to most other types of biomarker tests?
I would say, your physical function are really absolutely important tests. Certainly a person can go get a health exam and get a clean bill of health for their age and walk out and have a heart attack, but very few people could run on a VO2 max and get a significant score and then walk out the door and have a heart attack, I would think. And grip strength for aging population who are more older. Longer lived, I think Bill likes to say, which I really appreciate, certainly is a good measurement.
Great. Well, and you mentioned concierge medical services and medical tourism, and that's going to bring us into the next topic of this podcast, which perhaps Bill can describe to begin with here. And that's a concept or a way forward called best choice medicine. Bill, could you explain that to the listeners?
Well, first, let me say that it is actually Liz Parrish's brainchild. When she got her master's degree, she wrote her dissertation or thesis on that. And I was one of the reviewers, and I was just blown away with because it was very like-minded with the way I was thinking. And so we joined forces and we actually published a paper together. I don't have the reference handy right now, but we did publish a paper on best choice medicine. But best choice medicine is essentially like creating a new organization similar to the FDA that would be under Health and Human Services Division, but it would be different in that if you are diagnosed with a terminal disease and you get a doctor's saying you have a terminal disease, then you would fall under the jurisdiction of Best Choice Medicine, abbreviated BCM, instead of the FDA. There you would find that you have a lot more treatment options available to you that the FDA would normally restrict. And that's the whole idea. If you have a terminal disease, go for it. And if you are somebody that is close to dying and wants to be frozen, and you think that if you die, it's too late to be frozen, maybe you could have the option of being frozen while you're still alive, just before you die, where you FDA normally would not allow that. So that's pretty much the situation there. It's a new division of the Health and Human Services that would be focused on particular terminal patients.
And Liz, could you say, have you talked to many people in the industry or in the regulatory environment, the FDA, about this type of option for people?
So I actually speak globally on regulations, and I've worked with governments and I've helped to pass laws in other countries. We're hoping that this government going in especially will be receptive to this, because we just think that you don't have to really abolish the US FDA. You just need a pre-regulatory path to get innovative drugs in for patients who need them most. So we're really excited to talk about this with incoming groups that are coming into the government. This would be a critical environment for innovative medicine, especially, with the advances in AI. Everyone is so excited about that, but actually, they would be just as excited about medicine if you could see where it actually is right now.
And speaking of the regulations. I did interview someone in the past, not that long ago, who said that perhaps the FDA should stop at phase two, only to prove that a particular therapeutic or medication is safe, but then leave it up to the marketplace to see if it's effective to treat whatever condition you're trying to treat. Is that something that you've considered or heard about?
I've heard people say that, but actually, I think that best choice medicine would be your phase one and slash two, and the FDA could be phase three because titration is important. How much a drug does each person need for, their disease that they're treating? And so that could go off in a myriad path, but it shouldn't, come at a huge cost. That should be a streamlined position, and the drugs should go to market after phase two. So they should already be in market and being used and be marketable whilst they go through dosage.
Okay.
That's my
And
feeling. Phil, you may have a different opinion.
I agree, but I believe that phase three and phase four are absolutely essential. Otherwise, whether it's done by the FDA or just a peer-reviewed journal article on the subject, it's just there'd be too many treatments and drugs getting approved that are actually just snake oil water if all they do is they just test for safety.
Yeah, and as far as best choice medicine goes, obviously it's a pathway to get more people, more treatments. But how do we get into a position where there is so much bureaucratic red tape to get anything approved in the US or the EU in particular? I mean, obviously the idea is that the regulators want safe products out there, but it seems as though it's gone too far and they're preventing good treatments from being approved. And is that more of a negative than if it was a little less regulated?
There's actually a lot of stuff that's already happened in the direction that we're proceeding in, including, the pay-to-play model for clinical studies in case when drugs are so expensive that companies can't afford to pay for the clinical study. That was approved just in 2016. Then there was also RMAT, which stands for Regenerative Medicine Advanced Therapy. It was approved in 2016 for mostly regenerative medicines like gene therapy. And then there's re more recently, in 2018, there was the Right to Try Act passed, which allows people that in certain circumstances to be able to try treatments, drugs, and treatments that have at least passed phase one. And so we're just like the next step to even go beyond that. And one of the things that's being done, which we're both very excited about to promote this, is that the Coalition for Radical Life Extension is putting on a march in Washington, D.C. in spring of 2026. The name of the march is going to be called Rally for Longevity Rights, RLR, and it'll be spring of 2026.
Well, that is very good to hear because all three of us have been advocating for more life extension and rejuvenation treatments for a long, long time now. And it seems within our circle of acquaintances, everyone's very optimistic and everyone's working hard. But if I would have to say, since 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it seems like our group of advocates hasn't gotten that much bigger and hasn't seen that much more influence in like the halls of Congress or in the general public. What are your perceptions of that?
I think it's getting bigger. This march was announced just earlier this year, and it got a lot of response. They are trying to raise money to support the march. Is it okay if I give a website where people can go
Yes,
to if
please
they want
do.
to donate money? But it's RLE Coalition. So that's R as in Robert, L as in Lucy, E as in Edward, coalition.com/ ways to contribute, and there's dashes between the three words. So ways dash to dash contribute. You can go to that size because they're estimating that it's going to take about $500,000 to put on this march. And so far, I've been very impressed with the support that has been given. And I actually anticipate this will be a great march. The top thing on the agenda for this march is best choice medicine. Both Liz and I will be speaking at the Lincoln Memorial, where there'll be a rally after the march. And so we're pretty excited, but I think this is a absolute thing that needs to be done. And I don't think regulators that want to make restrictions and stuff like that are really going to be opposed to something like what we're proposing here.
It would seem difficult in my mind, in your mind, and Liz's mind. I know we think about it and we think, why would anyone oppose this? There are definitely treatments out there that could help millions of people who have terminal illnesses or chronic problems and just aging in general. And yet it's hard to get through to the general public. In the area where I live, not too many people talk about it, but perhaps a rally like that will help out. Any other things that you see positive, Liz, out there in the public recently?
Well, I think that the movement is growing. You see a lot of influencers are now around this space. I mean, I think that Kim Kardashian was talking about her telomere length, whether it was an appropriate test or not, I'm not sure. But I think that that's fantastic. People want to live longer, healthier. And I do believe that this march will help us because this is how HIV patients got drugs. This is how human rights issues changed globally. And so this could have a huge impact and it will have a global influence. So, other than that, I think what will change the impression is people actually seeing people get well. And so, best choice medicine, you had asked about the costs of regulations. This will reduce the cost, but it'll actually make drugs safer. The new drugs are safer. That's why the US FDA had to streamline a platform for gene and cell therapy. I don't know if you know this, but if gene therapies get into regulations, unlike small chemicals, they're actually put all the way through the regulatory process within 6 years. That means under 6 years, because the drugs are so exacting. We know what they create at the cellular level. The criteria is just as high for these drugs. The number of years you have to wash patients is longer, but the approval of the drugs is much faster. And so I think that we could see a compressed and compacted regulatory system with a pre-regulatory on-ramp like best choice medicine. So patients are actually getting medicine and then they're getting through the regulatory bodies faster and just as safe. And remember, the US FDA has approved the 10 least safe, most dangerous drugs on the planet. So, we can't expect them to continue to do the job that they're doing without assistance. And so this gives them the assistance that they need. They want to de-risk drugs. They want all of this animal research before they get a drug, but the animal research is not predictive of the outcome of the drug. As a matter of fact, that animal data comes with a 97% failure rate by the time you get to phase three, if you even make it. So we need a new system in which we have a body, a board of scientists that can actually approve what should go forward to humans and then give the access and the right to the doctor and the patient to choose what to take.
I hope we see some success with that coming up in the future. Let me avail you of a little story that's kind of funny about marches. I was talking with a Russian life extension activist, and he, back maybe 4 or 5 years ago, did a march in Moscow. And they marched down the street, disrupted traffic. The police came and beat him up and put him in jail, right? The protesters. I was talking with him in the US and he was telling me this story. And I said, oh, that sounds terrible. And he said, what would happen right now if we went out in the street? It was in Las Vegas. He said, what would happen if we went out in the street right now and stopped traffic downtown on the strip? I said, well, cops would show up. They would, kind of shuffle you off the street and say, break it up, break it up. And he says, well, is anyone gonna get beat up? I said, no. And is anyone gonna get arrested? I said, probably not. He said, why aren't we out there then? He said, let's go right now. But he couldn't get a bunch of people to go out there and block traffic on the strip in Las Vegas. So, kind of an interesting dichotomy there, where you would think there'd be more protests in the US because you're not going to suffer as much repression as you might in some other countries. But unfortunately, we haven't seen that too much. But we got the march coming up in the spring of 2026. That's good. Now, lastly, here, I just want to know each of you if you can give our listeners some actionable advice as far as health and supporting more research in the future. Like what you might do currently, what's the best bet for maintaining your health or achieving some form of rejuvenation, but also what to look forward to in the future. Bill, maybe go first.
Well, I always say exercise. I mean, it's just the most common things, but exercise, but doing it right. I always say if you're somebody that runs every 2 weeks and then runs in a marathon and does well and finishes across the finish line on your hands and knees throwing up, you're doing it all wrong. You got to be very consistent. You got to exercise, whether it's running, biking, kayaking, whatever, endurance sports. You got to be doing them all the time, and you got to keep them fun. Okay. And when they quit being fun, you got to quit. Okay. Save it for another day, because if you do that, you actually start making it so that even keeping it fun, you're doing really, really well. And it's really good for your endurance. That's one of the main things I say that it's important. But there's a lot of different healthy lifestyles. I think that everybody's different, okay, in terms of diet and things like that. I think that people should get their sensitivities, food sensitivities measured with ALCAT, ALCAT. They can Google that and find that. And then that will tell them what foods they can eat and what they can't eat, because they don't want to take foods that cause inflammation. And not everybody's different. Some foods cause some people inflammation, some others. Another new one is called MRT by the same inventor that created the ALCAT test. I've been looking forward to doing a side-by-side comparison of both, but I think they're going to be equal. But those are kind of the main things. I would also encourage everybody, and I've said this in my last talk, read Sandra Kaufman's books, Dr. Sandra Kaufman's. I think it's the best books ever written on supplements and stuff like that that people should be taking that are actually going to work for you. And she defines it in such an excellent way that it's easy. Okay,
And
she's
it's
got.
very, her book is very comprehensive and holistic,
Yeah.
you know, referencing the how everything works together, too, what I've seen. Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. Liz, what would you have to say? Obviously, people aren't all going to be able to afford the gene therapies that BioViva has been experimenting with, but some other things that
Are
perhaps.
you suggesting that I would shamelessly market my own?
No, I shamelessly market you all the time in BioViva. I tell people all the time, but I know that it is
Well, thank you.
relatively, it is pricey.
Well, so I'm certainly not a dietitian or a nutritionist, but I would suggest that depending on your age is how serious that you might want to be about it. And I guess that I'm just going to have to support Bill in this because, I go through a literature review of a myriad of things, and a lot of things come up in my searches, the things that search the web every day for me, and then the drop of the information on me. There were several things that I wouldn't do. Number one, I would not smoke. Number two, I would not drink excessively, especially binge drinking, because then your body can't epigenetically regulate to it. I'm not suggesting drinking in general. And number three, I would not fall for fad diets. And I would tell you that because I see this all the time where something becomes very popular to drop a bunch of weight, and then it leads to sarcopenia, cardiovascular disease, and a myriad of other things. And it only takes them a few years to find out. And that means that only in a few years, people are coming down with these conditions. So I'm a vegetarian, that's for certain, but I would make sure that I was eating in moderation. But then I would look at my age, and I would not take a clean bill of health if I was 80. I would be doing much more serious interventions at that point, because aging does come with 100% mortality risk. And I would talk to my doctor about that, talk to some functional medicine people, and then I would search the web for my options if I was enjoying my life and wanted to continue living it.
Oh, great. Well, it's a very optimistic podcast here. The two of you are real pioneers in rejuvenation research, and we are all grateful for all of the work that you do. Bill and Liz, thanks for joining us on the Longevity Now podcast.
Justin, we're thankful for you.
Can I say one thing more that I want to say that the Coalition for Radical Life Extension is not being selfish. They are actually looking for organizations to partner with. They want this to be the biggest thing. They don't want it to be all about them. So if Longevity or other organizations listening to this thing want to be part of this, and they want to have speakers join in on the rally, have them
Great.
contact our website.
Very good to know. Again, thank you so much for being on the Longevity Now podcast.
Oh, and please go to bestchoicemedicine.com and sign the petition if you believe that people should have access to innovative medicine.
In some recent podcasts, I've been lamenting the fact that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of progress in rejuvenation research and life extension advocacy. Over the last couple of decades, we've been working a long, hard time trying to get things moving forward. But Bill and Liz continue to provide us with a lot of positive information, not only on the practical side about what you can do to stay healthy and stay young, but also on the advocacy side. Please consider joining the march coming up in 2026. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.